So I was, yeah. So I was born in Denmark. My mother's Danish, but my father, he was from the island of Mauritius, which is somewhere around Madagascar, I guess, in the Indian Ocean, small island. And so he was, I think at the time, my mother told me, because I don't remember, of course, I don't know anything. He was studying in France, in Paris, and so he had some friends in Denmark. And he went on a vacation to Denmark and he met my mother. And they had like a short, relationship, and she became pregnant with me, and he left. From what I have told, he tried to at some point later, he tried to get in contact with me, but it somehow it didn't work out between them, and so he left, and I grew up with my mother, basically her raising me from that age.
How was it for you to grow up without a father? Was it a challenge?
Well, I guess at that time, because I didn't know better, I didn't know anything else. So I can definitely see, now what the challenges have been, and but I didn't know at that time, because it was normal to me that there was no father. To me, I didn't know anything else. I never thought about it, actually, I think, as being a child.
Did you end up getting in contact with him later on in life?
I did briefly when I was, I think I was 18. I spoke to him. I found him and I spoke to him, like I had a phone call with him. But because my life was a mess at that time, and I was, so in darkness, and I couldn't handle, and I spoke to him, and then I think he called me sometime. He called me one time in the middle of the night, and he was just dead drunk. And it was just too much for me to handle, because and I understood that, okay, he has alcohol problems. That's at least how I perceived it, and I just couldn't handle to take a, because I never knew him. I just wanted to know about him, but then I couldn't handle the problems maybe that would come with it.
Well, I'm sorry about this, but your life still turned out pretty good, so praise God. Let's go back to your childhood, because religion was a big part of it. But I want to ask you this question: like, what kind of religion and how big of a role did it play in your childhood living with your mom?
Well, when from the age of when I was born until the age of, I think, 7 or something, it didn't play any role. Like we were, I remember having, fun with my mom, and my grandparents were there, and everything was fine. But then what happened was when I became 8 or 9, I think I was 9 at some point, then my mother, she became a Jehovah's Witness. And so that changed everything, I would say, because she started to going to go to Jehovah's Witness meetings in their Kingdom Hall, how they call it, where they meet, and I was forced to go along, to come along. I didn't have a choice. I was still like a young child, so that was a huge change for me, and everything changed when that happened. It became very religious, a lot of rules, like you have to follow the rules, a lot of talking about God, of course, but the God that I saw there, and the God that I am, he was not a nice God. He was a God who was, yeah, I was told that he was a loving God, but if you can keep his standards, if you can stick to the rules, and I couldn't. It was hard for me. I was struggling, and I hated going to the meetings. So that changed my life. And also, I remember at a very young age, I was forced to go out on the street, and knock on people's doors, and with adults, and I absolutely hated it. I mean, it was terrifying, and of course, I didn't know anything about God or anything other than what they told me. I didn't have any personal relationship with God. I didn't have any will to seek God or any like at that age. I just wanted to play with my friends, and then I wanted to please my mom. So I went along and tried to be good and tried to be a good boy so that my mom would be pleased. So but inside it was, I hated it, absolutely hated it.
I'm curious because I've seen Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, come to my house and knock, and I wonder, how is it to actually do that? I don't have the experience, but you could talk about yours and how it was to go door to door and talk to people.
Oh, it was terrible. It was absolutely, I didn't want to do it, but you know, that was what they did. It was a part of their, you know, that they always quoted this, I think it's Matthew 24:14, that you know, that this gospel will be preached in all of the world, and then the end will come. And they use that, you know, always as saying that this is, so the gospel has to be preached, their gospel, of course, according to them. So that was what they were doing. But I also saw that there was a lot of like of earning your salvation, or earning, you know, God's favor, because God demanded this of you, that you go out and preach, you know, and you preach his word, or this gospel. It has to be preached, and people have to do it to be pleasing to God. So, but I absolutely hated it. I was terrified, but I was forced to do it. And then the other part of it was that I saw that it pleased my mom, and that was like so that became my motivation. That you know, even though I hated it and I was terrified of going out, but I wanted to please my mom. And I saw how other people looked at me and as a good example, you know, if I just behaved according to their rules and I followed the rules and I was like a good boy in Jehovah's Witnesses. So I did it just to get people's recognition.
I always feel bad for these people knocking on doors. First of all, because I think they get treated horribly from what I hear. And it's also like you're told that you need to do that in order to please God, in order to go to heaven. So they just, I mean, they don't know any better if they're like, whatever, 14, 15, 16, right? And so I feel bad. Yeah. I feel bad for these people. So I feel bad that you had to go through that. But moving along, how did that work when it came to your young adult years? Because, you know, you were saying you were doing that to please your mom, but there's usually a point that we get to where that starts to fade and we start to become our own person. How did that work with you? Did it shift you away from the beliefs of Jehovah's Witnesses?
Absolutely. I would say that, well, first of all, let me just say that maybe the mistake that I did, that I made, if I can say a mistake, was that at 14, I got baptized into the Jehovah's Witnesses. And that was a huge mistake on my part. Because for me, again, I did it to please them, to please my mother, and to please, you know, the people who were there in Jehovah's Witness. So, but because I saw some other young kids getting baptized, and I saw how people looked up to them. They were saying that, oh, this is such a good example of you know, and this is such a good, you know, like that he wants to get baptized and this thing, this is like a taking a stand for Jehovah, like they said. And I saw that, and I wanted that recognition. I wanted them to just say that I'm a good boy, you know, that I do well, you know. And I think every young people just want that, to be to know that you know they are doing well. So I got baptized, but not because I really understood it, what I was doing, or because I wanted it. I didn't, you know. It was just I wanted to please my mom and I wanted to please people. So I did it, but I didn't realize how big of a change that would do when I left, because I ended up leaving the year after, actually, when I became 15. But I didn't understand at the time when I took the baptism that once you're baptized, that's it. You're in. And if you ever decide that you don't want to be a part of it anymore, you're shunned. You know, they shun you out. You know, they will they don't want to, no one will talk to you. No one will have anything to do with you. So you're basically left out. And in the Jehovah's Witnesses, they only associate with other Jehovah's Witnesses. It's a very like a closed community in that way. So if you're shunned, you're basically like kicked out by everybody, and they, you know, like a nobody, and you know, the feeling of that is just terrible. And that would not have happened to me if I would not have been baptized that year before.
So they would have been fine with you just never accepting it and never get baptized. But because you got baptized now, all of a sudden,
absolutely.
Why does it change so much?
Because to them, the baptism is the statement that now you are, you know, you belong to Jehovah and you belong to the Jehovah's Witnesses. You're a part of that, and you can't just leave. I mean, if you do, they will have nothing to do with you. If I had not gotten baptized, you know, it would be fine. Of course, they would have talked to me. They would have called me in and talked to me and said to me that and warned me and said, you know, that this is not right. You know, you're like, you know, be careful what you're doing and stuff like that. But they would not have shunned me. So that was the difference.
I guess there's something similar in Islam, where if you're not a Muslim, they're fine with you. But if you were a Muslim and you leave, now all of a sudden they really don't like you and they try to ruin your life. So I guess there's an example of that in other religions. What happened with you? Because your mom had to shun you too. Like, well, how did it work?
Yeah, well, she did to some extent, but still, of course, because she's my mom. So of course, you know, I was still like talking to her, but the relationship was, you know, never the same. So she would talk to me, but others, Jehovah's Witnesses, they wouldn't. But also, you know, my problem was that I was rebellious. I mean, I became a troubled, rebellious teenager at 15 when the hormones started kicking in, and you know, I had been so oppressed, you can say, like you know, because I was not allowed to have any fellowship or to play with other children when I was younger. From that, when my mother became a Jehovah's Witness, I was told that I was only allowed to play with the other Jehovah's Witnesses' children. So I had a very limited, you can say, like friend circle, you know, because they were all Jehovah's Witnesses. So I didn't have any friends outside of, and I was, you know, after school, I had to come directly home. I was not allowed to go to other children's birthdays. You know, I was not allowed. There was no Christmas. There was like, everything was like, you know, and so I became also at school, I became like, you know, the outsider, the weird one. And that really affected me a lot. You know, it's not nice for a child to be, you know, the only one who's not allowed to come to a birthday party or is not allowed to play with other kids. So it affected me a lot.
But did you still live with your mom? Did she let you live there even though you had rejected it?
I did, but because, yeah, she allowed me to stay. Like, I had a room in her apartment. And I stayed, I think, for some time. But then because I was so rebellious, because what happened was that because I had been so oppressed, I when I went out from that, I exploded. It was like a bomb going off, like inside of me. All that oppression, suppression, all those rules, that suddenly I was free. That's how I felt. Suddenly I was free from all of that. And no one told me that you can't do this and what I'm allowed to do and not. And I didn't have to go to meetings. I didn't have to, you know, sit quietly. I didn't have to go and knock doors and everything. So it was like a bomb going off. And I wanted to go out and experience everything, you know, yeah, everything you can imagine. And I did. And that was also, that was not only good things. You know, I experienced a lot of bad things. And because I ended up, I didn't have any friends. So the friends that I did end up having or meeting, they were other children who were like troubled teens, you would say, that had, you know, they were also had been, they had either run away from home or had been kicked out by their parents. And I met them on the streets, you know, so I quickly became a part of that environment. like there was drugs and alcohol and also, you know, we started doing like criminal things, like breaking into places and stealing things and like that. And that came to me at that age. And so because I didn't want to be with my mom, I didn't want to have anything to do with what she was, you know, into, it ended up that I moved out at that age. Already at 15, I moved out from my mom. And it was not like she told me to move out, but it was like I was so rebellious that I didn't want to stay with her. So I wanted to just go out and do my thing. And I was filled with anger also. I was angry also about the way that, you know, people had treated me and, you know, like all these things, like filled with rage and it was a tough time.
So I'm not sure if I understood everything correctly. Did you say that you lived on the street? You were homeless for a time?
Yeah, basically like, so I had a friend who was also in the Jehovah's Witness, and he left at the same time with me. I think he was one or a couple of years older than me, maybe. And he left at that same time. So we were like kind of like sticking together, like keeping together. And his father, he had an apartment. So his father was living, he had a wife and children somewhere else, but he also had an empty apartment. So he allowed us to stay there. In that apartment. So in that way, we were not homeless. We had a place to sleep, but, you know, the place was just filled with drunk teenagers, like every day, and taking drugs. And even I remember one time police came and, you know, kicked in the door and you know, searching for stolen goods. And it was it was rough.
How many years did that last, this period of your life?
That lasted from 15 to 18, so a couple of years. No, 17, it was I think I was 17 when I got out of it. Almost 18, maybe, yeah.
And how did you get out? What'd you do? How did you turn your life around?
So what happened was that from being in this environment for a couple of years with all these things going on, many of my friends, they started to get, you know, like I said, police came to the apartment, you know, looking for people, for some of my friends, looking for, you know, stolen stuff in the apartment. So what I saw some of them started to get arrested and going to prison, actually, to jail. That was kind of like a wake up call to me, because something in me was still saying that, okay, you know, you should not, that's not how your life should end, you know. So I got this thought that I need to get out of this environment, but I didn't know what to do, because I didn't want to go back to Jehovah's Witnesses for sure. So I started thinking about how can I get out, how can I escape this environment. And in Denmark, there is such a thing that if you're not studying, like after the normal school, you finish high school or whatever they call it. Yeah, I think it's high school. If you're not continuing in some studies, or you're doing nothing, then kind of like the government, they are like, you know, they are checking up on you. Like they send someone to check up on you, like an advisor or a counselor or something, like a school counselor, you could say. And this woman came to me, and she asked me that, what am I doing? That you know, like she can see that I'm not studying, I'm not doing anything, I'm just, you know, like wasting time. So she wanted to help me, and I already wanted to get out from there. So I told her about my situation. I told her that I'm in a bad situation, that I have bad friends and wrong friends, and you know, and I really would like to leave the place where I was. So she had some friends in Poland. They were like teachers, like they were like teachers from a school in Poland. And she contacted them, and she arranged for me to go there and study like Polish language, like to study to become an interpreter or translator. So that was not really my idea at all, but it was just a way for me to get out from the place that I was. So that was my ticket out of Denmark and away from the environment that I was, the bad environment. So that became my escape. Yeah. So I went and I lived in Poland for a couple of years after that.
That's actually pretty cool that they give resources to, you know, kids, teenagers in the situations that you were in. I'm wondering, did you have any aspirations in your life at that point in terms of goals or anything that you wanted to do?
No, not really. I was lost. I didn't have anything, you know, like I was only thinking about the here and now. Like, where am I now? Where is this leading me? You know, this is not good. I just need to you know, get out of here. So that was my only thought at that time.
So what transpired in the years after that? To my understanding from your story, from the bit that we talked, there was a decent amount of time in your adult years where you were going through, I guess you could say, like a fairly normal life. Can you explain, yeah, you know, what happened there and how that ended?
So, yes. So what happened was that when I moved to Poland, I met a girl who became my wife. So I thought that, okay, now this is going somewhere. I can start to have a normal life. I started to have these ambitions to, you know, to get a wife, a family, and normal life, a good job, you know. And when I met my wife, she wanted the same. She wanted to have a good job, and she was like very like into to career and you know, she wanted to have a good life. So she didn't want to live like like I used to live. So she became like my, in that way, support. In that we moved, both of us. We got married. And she moved with me back to Denmark, but so we started basically a whole new life, and we started to you know, we started a family. We got, I have two children in Denmark with her, and we started working. We got, you know, we got to buy a house. We had, you know, everything what you can think, what I thought at that time, that that's what life is about, you know, that is what happiness is about, that and the goal in life, it's just that you get married, you get kids, you have a good job, you have a house, nice house, nice car, you know. And I had all of that between 18 and I think 32, something like that. Those years I was having a fairly normal life, but still actually not, when I think about it, because what happened was that because we you know, I always wanted to have a new car. I always wanted to have like the best, or go somewhere on vacation every summer, you know, like, so you need money to do that, right? So I needed to work so much, and I had a loan on the house and everything that needed to be paid every month. So because I had all these loans and expenses, I needed to work a lot. So I ended up having to work two jobs, like a day job. And then I was working for a security company during the day. And then at night I was working as a bouncer in a club in the city. So the people that I was working with, they were like, at that time, I was working out a lot, and they were also, you know, we were working out a lot and going to the gym, and many of them were using steroids. And because they were working in the security business and you know, in the clubs, in that whole scene. So they were using steroids, but not only that, also you know, different kind of methamphetamines to be able to go, you know, to work through the night without being tired. So, and I knew what that was because I had been, when I was, you know, already when I left at 15, the Jehovah's Witnesses, I started also taking amphetamines and with these friends that I met on the street. So I knew what that was, but now I just had some colleagues I was working with who got it, who could sell it to me. So I started using that. So you can say that I became a working addict, I think they call it. So on the outside, it looked like everything was fine. I had a job, I had a family and everything. There was nothing on the outside that would indicate that there was a problem. But I was addicted. I became addicted to having these amphetamines to give me energy, you know, to be able to go through the work. So I became addicted already then. So there was a problem. And well, I can just mention one other thing. I was pornography was the second, I think, of my really like big addictions, because I had been, you know, I remember already at an early age, some of it was not like at that time, because I'm not so young anymore. So the internet was not so it was not so accessible through the internet. But then it was magazines, and I remember when a kid in when I was in school already showing me his dad had some magazines, you know, like, and I was exposed to that like at an early age, and that became like an addiction that followed me throughout my life. And then when the internet came, that just exploded because it was so accessible. And that followed me through my marriage also. So I would secretly, you know, be watching this pornography and, you know, and taking these, you know, amphetamines. And I didn't always tell my wife what I had been taking, you know, when I was at work, because she would have, you know, said something. She knew to an extent that I was, you know, using some kind of tablets or pills. I was taking some pills, but she didn't know to the extent that it really was, that it was a problem to me.
What you're telling me sounds like a recipe for disaster. Like you say, you were addicted to porn in your marriage. You were working two jobs in order to have enough money, but in order to be able to work these two jobs, you were compensated with amphetamines. That's not something that you can do forever. And so did it ever come to a point that you just crashed out of it?
And that was exactly what happened. And now fast forward to when I was 32, that happened. One day I was 32. I didn't work those jobs anymore at that time. I was actually working at a hospital. But it was still like a stressful work, like a lot of hours. And I did a lot of overtime also. So one morning I just, you know, all the time I was taking these things, I never stopped. Even I changed work, I never stopped taking these amphetamines, you know, to give me energy to be able to go through the day. So one day I just woke up and I couldn't go to work. Like my body just couldn't take it. And mentally I couldn't take it, you know, I couldn't go through the day. So I couldn't get out of bed, and that became the beginning of my depression. You say, I mean, really, that was the start of a really, really deep depression for me. So I basically got a burnout. Yeah.
And did what happened to that depression? How big was it? Did you see any doctors? You know, what was going on with that?
So of course, in the beginning, they gave me like a sick leave, because I couldn't like a normal, so I didn't have to go to work. But that only lasted for a certain amount of time, because you know, there came a time and I still couldn't continue to go to work. I was seeing the doctor. They tried to give me antidepressive medication, but nothing worked. And they changed that many times, you know, to try to give me something different, and nothing worked. It just got worse. So at one point, my boss at my work, he said that you know, we're sorry, but we have to let you go, because, you know, we don't see any you getting better or anything. And of course they had to, you know, take someone else in to fill my place. So I lost my job. My family fell apart, you know, and I was so depressed. I couldn't be with my children. You know, I didn't have time. I couldn't take care of them. Like they would come to me and they wanted to play. They wanted to do things with me. And I was just so depressed and so tired that I didn't have the strength to do it. So everyone suffered. My wife suffered. Of course, you know, I was not giving her any attention, and that had been going on for years, like, because I was like a zombie, basically. So everything fell apart. My marriage fell apart, my job, because I couldn't pay the bills, of course. Then we had to sell the house. I had to sell my cars, you know, everything I had been building up in my own strength, you know, my own, you know, small kingdom, you know, in my own strength. It felt like, you know, in a very, very short period of time, like the carpet was just pulled from under me and everything just came tumbling down. And I ended up from having, you can say, everything what you would think that happiness and life is about to ending up in a small two-bedroom apartment with, you know, with severe depression and social anxiety. That was the second thing that came in, that I started to get afraid of people, to, you know, to being around people. I couldn't handle even going to the store. You know, I couldn't do almost, you know, I couldn't go out to my mailbox outside the door of my apartment to get the mail. My curtains were closed like all the time, dark room. I wouldn't let any light in. You know, I couldn't handle daylight or I wouldn't answer my phone. I couldn't handle talking to people. If someone would call me, I would just leave it. You know, it was like, I didn't shower. I didn't shave. I didn't anything. I mean, I couldn't, it was like, yeah, it was bad.
That's so sad. I hate to see families break apart like that. So that's unfortunate. I know that happens, maybe not exactly the circumstances that you had, but things like that happen a lot. And that makes me very sad. But how did you get out of that? Because eventually you must have needed to come out. So how did you do that?
So once again, because I was living in Denmark, and you know, the social system in Denmark is very good. Like it's one of the best in the world. So the society, you know, the government and everything, you know, they are very much, you know, like about supporting people and looking after someone, you know, is so in that way, they were trying to, they, you know, all the time get me up. And so after a period of time of being so depressed, you know, I think it was like 2 years, yeah, from 32 to 34, I was in that state, like just at home, isolated in that state. Oh, and I just want to mention, and that was also the state when I became suicidal. I started to have suicidal thoughts that you know, I might as well just end it, because I didn't see any hope, and I, you know, and it was so bad. I was actually on the internet looking how to, you know, reading forums, chat rooms, you know, like how you know, to commit suicide, you know, the easiest way. It was that bad. And then, of course, the porn addiction was there all the time. You know, I was a slave to that, you know. And it just became deeper and deeper. But then after 2 years, I remember I went to see my doctor, because I was regularly meeting with my doctor, because he was trying these antidepressive medicines throughout these 2 years. And they would, I can't even count how many different, you know, I have brands and I have tried, but nothing helped. So after 2 years, I spoke with my doctor, and he said to me, I don't know how to help you, but I can only try to help you, as you know, to make your life as easy as possible. So my biggest problem was that I was sleeping all the time. I was sleeping all night, but also all day. So I was only, you know, awoke for a few hours, like every day. And then I was sleeping the rest. I was so tired, exhausted. So he said, that is your main problem, that you can't get out. You cannot get out of bed. So what he came up with, crazy, because he didn't know what to do. So he gave me a receipt. He gave me like a prescription for amphetamine, It's called dextroamphetamine in tablets. And I think they give it, it's similar to also what they give to ADHD, you know, people like some, but when you don't have ADHD, it works as an amphetamine. It you know, it gives you energy. It you know, quickens your brain, you know, it wakes it up about your brain and you get, you know, you get energetic. So I started taking that. And it works just as amphetamine. I mean, the feeling I had was exactly the same as when I had been earlier in my life taking amphetamine. So suddenly I could get up. When I, you know, I would wake up in the morning, I would take a pill, I would wait 15 minutes for it to work, and then I would jump out of bed and I would be ready, you know, and so it went from one extreme of doing nothing, just sleeping all the time, being depressed, to being over, you know, active and not sleeping at all and not eating. So I also lost a lot of weight, you know, like that. And I was also smoking cigarettes, you know, during that time. And so I was like just smoking from, you know, day and night and just, you know, being on the internet, watching pornography and, you know, being on the internet, playing games, watching TV, but I was energetic. So, but I became so addicted. Like, again, that was like, you know, yeah, it got me out of bed, but I was kept by this medication. So of course, because amphetamines, anybody who knows anything about it will know that your tolerance grows. That you know, it's not like you can keep having this, taking the same dose and it just keeps working. So my body got used to it, of course. So all the time I had to increase the doses and go to my doctor and say that then it's not working anymore. You know, now I start feeling tired again. And when in reality, I wasn't sleeping at all. So I wasn't even thinking that I need to sleep. So I was just going for days sometimes. And then I would sleep. Then I could sleep for 2 days in a row. And then, you know, I would go for a week again. I mean, it was crazy. But every time he just kept giving me like higher dose, like, and I in the end, before I came off it, by the grace of God, I was taking, some days I was taking 15, between 15 and 20 tablets every day.
I don't know how much that is, but that sounds like a lot.
It's a lot. It was like, you know, it was just like all the time. I was just taking, as soon as I started getting the high, the feeling of high, I would just take another pill. So I would go through the day and night like that. So it was just crazy. Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, I think this is about the time or close to when you met your girlfriend, which we're going to talk about that whole story. But how did you meet her?
So I met her because now suddenly I had energy. And I felt like, you know, I want to go out and party. I want to go out and meet these women because now I am not, you know, I don't have some social anxiety anymore. So it was like, you know, it was at least that was how I felt. So suddenly I could talk to people. I could talk to women. I could, you know, get up, get things done. So I thought, wow, this is great. I'll just start, you know, having a party, having fun. So I would start dating all these women, you know, like I would also be like in dating chat rooms, you know, like just, you know, like chatting with women and meeting with them and, you know, like these things. So it became like an obsession to me. So I met this woman in an internet chat room. Or on a dating site, I think.